Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. As we look back over the last year, our headline figures indicate that ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, has spent in excess of £8.4 million supporting some 60,000 soldiers, veterans, and their immediate families in 63 countries across the globe. Our youngest beneficiary being a 2-year-old child, and our oldest, 103-year-old veteran. Unlike many military charities, we neither rely on government funding nor have service contracts with the NHS or local authorities. We are therefore entirely reliant on you, our ever generous supporters. And following the year we have just had, in particular, on behalf of our Chief Executive, General Martin Rutledge, and all the staff and volunteers at the Soldiers' Charity, we would like to say an especially big thank you. To give you a feel for just some of our fundraising activity, on the 5th of March, we held Friday Night In, an evening of military entertainment, interviewing games, which raised over £23,500. In this edition of General Talk, TV news presenter Sam McCoy talks to the BBC's Claire Balding about her life in broadcasting, connections with the military, and surprising knowledge about the workings of a Challenger tank. I hope you enjoy the programme.
Claire Balding, it is a great pleasure to talk to you. We all know that whatever channel we put on these days, you're going to be on it one way or another. So thank you for your time. And it's a very difficult time that we're all going through at the moment. And a lot of people, I suspect, shared that sense of relief when we heard that the military was being brought in to help. And I just wanted your perspective as we start. During this crisis, what does military involvement mean to you when we're talking about such big projects, problems as we have now?
I think as soon as I hear that the British Army or the armed forces are getting involved, I know that everything will be done in an organised manner and calmly and efficiently. And I know certainly from what happened at the London Olympics, they were transformed by army involvement. And that's because I think you've got people who can do a job extremely well, but they're so comfortable with what they do and with the communication between them and their team that actually they manage to drop any sense of pressure or stress, and they can do it in a way that makes you smile. And that makes all the difference. And I think particularly when we're going through a situation as we are at the moment, where a lot of people are scared and they tend to panic when they're scared, you need people around who are never going to panic, and you need to feel that you're in safe hands. And I think that's what the involvement of the armed forces brings. And we're very, very lucky to have so many people, and I think particularly of soldiers and their families, who've given up an awful lot to make sure that we as a population can be safe and can be vaccinated quickly, and that life can, in one way or another, start to get back to some sense of normal. And I think everyone clinging on to that hope, and it becomes ever closer.
Of course, the worlds of sport and the military are never far apart. I'm watching Sports Personality of the Year, of course, and there was that moment where Captain Tom appears. There is something about old soldiers that just makes you smile and makes you take stock a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. It's that absolute combination of the discipline and the sense of humour, and Captain Tom certainly has that. And I know actually that link between the military and sport is very strong. I mean, the Paralympic Games started as the wheelchair games at Stoke Mandeville for injured servicemen after the Second World War. And the Invictus Games that Prince Harry has obviously started is the continuation of that idea. I think the Paralympics, which I've presented for a long time, have become so elite that actually they were rather distanced from that original concept. And that's why the Invictus Games were deemed necessary. And I think were much more successful, actually, than anyone would have realised. And I presented the first ones in London. And it was amazing, actually, in seeing Prince Harry cycling around Olympic Park with a very small team, who he was constantly leaving behind him, going off to venues just because he wanted to see something. It really made me laugh because I thought he's such a free spirit. And that those games, the Invictus Games, had that element of him and still do. They have that sort of freedom and edginess and sense of fun, while also understanding that crucial role that sport can play in giving people a sense of purpose, a sense of representing their country, a sense of risk-taking, all of which I think are very tightly combined with the armed forces, the army specifically, but that sense of discipline and having a goal, but you're having it as a shared goal. And I think that's really, that is the joy of sport and sports events.
And boy, didn't we see that with Strictly and JJ Chalmers, our colleague.
Absolutely. I mean, JJ's remarkable and I've worked with JJ a lot. And you're right. I think Strictly Come Dancing is very aware that it can visually represent to a massive audience of tens of millions of people the full range of human diversity. And that includes people who have physical challenges that you might assume would stop them from dancing. And I think what Johnny Peacock and JJ Chalmers have proved so beautifully and brilliantly was that absolutely that is not the case. And JJ applied himself as he would do to any task. And my word, didn't he improve him? He'd only packed for 2 or 3 weeks, and suddenly, you know, 7 or 8 weeks later, he's still there. And again, I think his military training helped him in that sense of sacrifice. He had to be away from his family, and he's got young children, and he had to be away from his wife for over 2 months in the end. And, you know, you have to have a certain mindset to get through that without suffering too badly. And although he missed them horribly, I think he certainly didn't let it affect his performance, and he continued to try as hard as he could.
There's a professional soldier who's gone into broadcasting. There's that old mantra that those that can do, those who can't go into broadcasting. But I'm just wondering, how it was for you, because what was that step that made you think actually broadcasting and broadcasting in sport is my idea of heaven?
Well, I'm not sure I ever had it as a goal as a child. And I don't know, Simon, whether you looked at the news and thought, that's what I want to do. Did you know that it was what you wanted?
Do you know, it's what I always wanted to do. So I'm blessed, but I'm a rarity.
But I watch sport a lot, and I loved watching sport, and I've always had a passion for all sorts of sports, not just the equine ones. Although, you know, I'd certainly put equestrian sport at the top of my list of things that I love doing, and specifically actually 3-day eventing, which started at the Olympics only for, I think maybe only for officers, but certainly it was very much aimed at cavalrymen. And I think when they had the Olympic Games in London in 1948, I think the equestrian events were held at Twickenham, which is a big army, not Twickenham, sorry, were held at Tweedledum, which is a big army base, very sandy soil and very good. So even in the summer, you get good going. And I'm pretty certain that our first Olympic team, I think Captain Harry Llewellyn was the sort of head of that team, but it was very much around, and badminton when it started, badminton horse trials was started as a prep to try and get us to perform better at the Olympics, because I think we hadn't done terribly well, and then we got much better at it. But equestrian sport has always had a very close link. But I wanted to go into eventing. That's what I wanted to do as a child. And watching it as a sport, I could see the success of someone like Lucinda Pryor-Palmer, as she was before she was married, or Ginny Leng, or later Mary King, and think, gosh, women can do that and they can compete against men. Now, if I looked at television, maybe in news, there would have been a few. Anna Ford, I remember absolutely, I loved Anna Ford as newsreader.
We all loved Anna Ford. Yeah.
I see her occasionally when I'm walking on the towpath, I bump into her occasionally, and she's just brilliant. But Selena Scott obviously would have been very, very high profile when I was younger. But in sport, there were very few women doing the job that I then went on to do. So Sue Barker had probably just about started, and she started at Sky in its early days and then came to the BBC. Helen Rollison was the first woman to present Grandstand. Hazel Irvin's only a little bit older than me, but there weren't many. So you're not looking at it as an industry thinking, oh, there's a clear path there, I can do that. But that didn't stop me trying. So I sort of fell into it by accident on the radio. Well, yeah.
Well, how lucky was that? But of course, for many people, it was London 2012. It was the swimming pool. I mean, did you realise then how your career was about to change with that coverage?
Well, luckily for me, I was 41 by the time London 2012 came along. So it wasn't as if I was this fresh, young, overnight sensation who didn't know how to, you know, didn't know how it all works out. And I was very aware that, I wasn't aware at the time that anyone was saying anything because I was really disciplined about it. I totally threw myself into that event. And it was all about the event for me. I was looking outwards so much that I wasn't really caught. I mean, God, most of the clips, when you look at me, I in the mornings, I was doing my own makeup in the loo at the aquatic centre, so I look awful. I'm wearing whatever shirt I found. You know, I there's no particular sense of this is going to be a big audience. You need to, you know, brush your hair. There's not even that. But I had done the work, and it was a great example of homework always pays. And I loved that. Two and a half week, nearly 3 week period. And then I was presenting the Paralympics for Channel 4. So there was about a 2 week gap. But I was not that interested in what other people thought I did. And that, I think, was probably why it was so well received. And I ended up getting lots of awards, which essentially were a reflection of other people's excellence. I mean, either the production team and the TV coverage, or actually our athletes. I think if we hadn't done so well, I'm not sure, you know, anyone would have got any glory in the broadcasting world. But I was, the one I was particularly proud of, the Channel 4 BAFTA for coverage, because that was up against the BBC doing the Olympics. So I was a bit conflicted because obviously I've been heavily involved in both. But I was really pleased that the Paralympics got it, because I thought they had changed the way, and I really knew because I had done the Paralympics previous to that, I thought they really changed the way it was covered and therefore changed perception.
I'm interested and in awe. You talk about doing your homework, and that mantra, fail to prepare, prepare to fail. It sounds almost military, might well be, but you've got military in your personal history. Do you think that has any bearing on this? You do things very straight, don't you? You have a target and you go for it.
I'm certainly not afraid of hard work, and I'm not afraid of ambition either. I think a lot of women are conditioned to believe that's something that men can talk about and women aren't allowed to, that somehow it's unfeminine. I believe very strongly that all girls and all women should be ambitious. I think we should be trying to achieve more, do more, try and do things that push us out of our comfort zone. I think that's terribly important. But yeah, my grandfather and my great-grandfather, one was in Scots Guards, one was in the Welsh Guards, but my father wasn't in the army. I don't know how he got, well, he was a schoolboy for a very long time. He took his A-levels many times. Therefore, he somehow didn't get called up. You know, he didn't have to do national service, which, given he's 80, I don't know how, it might have been because he was an American citizen then. So he was born in America, educated over here, and eventually became a British citizen when he was about 40. But I had a boyfriend in the army who was Queen's Royal Irish Hussars when I was in my teens and at university. So I was very well aware of life in army camps, whether it was Fallingbostel or Catterick Garrison or indeed, you know, winter skiing expeditions, which seemed to go on many months. But yeah, I've always been very well aware, you know, I do understand army life. And funny enough, his commanding officer was called Colonel Arthur Denaro. And when I was presenting Trooping, I presented Trooping the Colour, or reported on it for many years, which involved I was allowed to ride out with the Household Cavalry in Hyde Park, which is a really rare thing to be allowed to do. And I would report on the King's troopers. They came on to the parade square at Horse Guards. And I still get excited by that, the role of thunder that the guns create. And The King's Troop is very, very female friendly, and I've been and done quite a lot of filming there because girls and women like working with animals. They like working with horses, and therefore there are an awful lot of women, I think more than 50%. They were in St John's Wood, and I rode out there many years ago, and now they're in Woolwich, and I've been there and had a look at the facilities, which are fantastic. But Colonel Arthur, I suddenly came across him at the Lord Mayor's show. I was presenting the Lord Mayor's show, and we'd asked permission if I could get into a tank and for one of the links. Okay, typical. So I climb and they tell me, hear this voice saying, "You understand a tank, don't you, Balding?" I said, "Yes, I do, sir." You know, sometimes those connections which are like way back, you remember those. And I saw him, and he's very distinctive looking. He's got a very strong jaw. And I thought, I know who that is. It's Colonel Arthur, my God.
Well, many people will remember you and Who Do You Think You Are, discovering more about your links historically with the army. But how much of an eye-opener was that to you?
The whole programme, honestly, Simon, it really is a surprise where they take you. So they don't tell you where you're going to do any of your filming. I didn't even know. I mean, I suspected I might end up in America for some of it because, you know, as I said, my father was American. But I didn't know that I'd go to New York, and I didn't know what I would discover in the UK. So they did my mother's family and then my father's family, both of which were fascinating. The army route, they didn't really delve into that much because that my grandfather wasn't a part of this program. It was very much my grandmother's line. If we were talking racehorses, it was the dam side and then the dam's dam. So we were going through that very strongly on the female line. But it was great fun. I mean, gosh, it's a wonderful program to be involved in. And when they reveal things to you, you've spent such a long time building up to the reveal that you feel that you really know your ancestors, and then consequently when something shocking happens and it's revealed to you in a letter or a news story, you are going to react emotionally. And I, for all that I said I wouldn't cry, I did get quite choked reading letters and newspaper reports of my great grandmother's death, and she was killed very, very young in a fall from a horse.
Can I just go back to the King's Troop? Because I think you did a programme for Radio 4, and in it looked at whether there was a future for horses in the army. Did it come to a conclusion?
Well, as we're aware, in terms of warfare, thankfully, the answer is no, there isn't. But I think in terms of the teaching discipline and empathy and clarity of thought, I think horses are really, really useful. And that ceremonial soft power has a major impact. And when you look at military forces around the world, it's far more often now that they are going to be a visual ceremonial sense of power. That you're going to see them, because we don't really see warfare, thankfully, in the same way. So I still think they have a major role, and I think they're terribly important for lots of mental health reasons. But I think also there is that, the discipline that they teach you, and also the lack of pride. You can't be an arrogant sod around a horse. You really can't, because they'll make you look stupid in 2 seconds.
While we're on animals, let me talk about dogs, because, again, dogs in the army. Only a few months ago, a dog received a military honour. And the interesting thing about that, this dog had served in Afghanistan, had lost both hind legs, and was fitted with prosthetics. And what that told you was not just what an amazing dog it was, but how the army looks after its animals. And that's an important aspect of all this as well.
Yeah, I did a lot of research into various animals, whether they be dogs, a donkey actually in Gallipoli, pigeons, G.I. Joe being a very famous example of an American pigeon who played a crucial role in the Second World War, but also there were pigeons in the First World War. I was writing a book called Heroic Animals last year, and I was really touched by that, of not only the role that animals played, and dogs, you know, hugely cherished within the army and quite often as their mascots, but there in the, you know, if you think of the squalor of the trenches, actually having any dog or any animal, even rats were tended to, gave soldiers something different to focus on, and a sense not just of comfort, but a sense of responsibility and of being able to be useful and usefully looking after something else. But there's a story about a dog that was called Cromwell, who they think was almost the first therapy dog, and it happened really by accident. But with soldiers coming back from the Second World War, having suffered, you know, huge trauma, and this dog just knew who to go to and how to be around them. But there are lots of examples. Even more recently, a dog called Barry, who Sean Laidlaw, I think, was his was the soldier who brought him back in the end from Syria. And Sean was suffering from PTSD, and he absolutely believes that Barry saved his life. And he had gone through an awful lot in Afghanistan, I think, that was extremely difficult to process. Yeah. So I think, and as we know, bomb detection dogs are, you know, they save hundreds, if not thousands, of lives on a regular basis. Dogs are capable of so many things, and I think the Army's been aware of that for probably longer than everyone else, and absolutely honours them, protects them, cherishes them, and understands their value.
Just want to move on to broadcasting. We lost recently Peter Alice, of course, the voice of golf. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just his knowledge of the game, wasn't it? And without sparing your blushes, it's that broader appeal that makes certain sports broadcasts, and I would include you absolutely top of this list. People feel they know you, they appreciate your humour, and how important is that for a sports broadcaster?
That's incredibly kind of you. I'll say, first of all, thank you. And I'm not very good at taking compliments, and I'm not going to bat it away as I normally would. I'm just going to say thank you. I think authenticity is the most important thing in all our lives. And it doesn't matter what job we're doing, whether you're a teacher, an army officer, a soldier, a broadcaster. You can't truly connect with people and communicate with people unless you are aware of your own vulnerability. And unless you have the ability, and Simon, you do this a lot, unless you have the ability of laughing at yourself, and you've got to laugh in certain situations. We can't all be.
It's all right for yeah. you. I do it in the middle of the news. I get into trouble. For you, it's lovely.
You don't get into trouble. People love that. They're waiting for that moment. Like, when to give him a story that he can't get through, because this will be good.
And they normally feature animals.
Yeah, exactly. I think television is so different to other mediums, and it's interesting because I've taken a long time to learn this. I started in radio, and it's quite easy to be relaxed and confident on radio without being overconfident. I think in television you almost have to think a little slower, speak a little less, listen more, and when things go wrong, either say sorry really quickly or learn to laugh. You can't take it all too seriously, because I think if you do, you carry this weight around that's very heavy, and I don't want people watching to feel burdened by, you know, to be thinking, oh, she's going to make a mistake any minute now. It doesn't matter if I make a mistake, which I'm highly likely to do. It's all right. The programme will go on. I'll recover. We'll all recover. It'll be fine. And I, you know, the things that are hardest to do, that require the most retention of information, are things like an Olympic opening ceremony. Because you have, and I'm not doing commentary on the ceremony, and that's hard enough, but at least they can look at their notes. I'm reacting, well, first of all, predicting what might happen and having a broad knowledge of all the nations and their leading athletes. That's pretty important. And then after the end of it, you're reacting quite quickly. And actually, I take longhand notes. I mean, I'm really old fashioned. I have all sorts of books sat around my desk. So that's my rugby league notebook. That's a general notebook for last year. There's another one here on tennis. There's another one on Paralympics. I have lots of different notebooks with different subjects in them. And I'll sit and obviously write a lot of notes before an event, but then you don't know what's going to happen. So you have to have the freedom of mind and the clarity of thought to respond to what you think is the major message coming through. And actually, with an opening ceremony, it's more, it's about speeches and it's about the artistic nature of that ceremony. And the same with sport, it's a lot about performance and what it makes you feel, as well as the outcome. It's what does it do to people? And I think that's where London 2012 was so unusual. And I'm not sure we'll ever, any of us, go through anything like that again, where the whole nation felt on a high throughout that whole summer. And it was such a moment of pride that we did do it well. We did it really well. And all the voices of doom in all the usual sectors of the written press were predicting it as a disaster for months on end beforehand. And it wasn't. It was anything but. It was a triumph. So
you've covered, I think, 6 Olympics. Is that right?
96 my first one. So.
I just wonder what... Well, you've got Tokyo coming up, of course, this year. It's going to be a very different feel, obviously, given the situation we're in. Who knows whether it will actually end up going ahead. But presumably, you're still working it. You're already getting the details. You're doing the work.
Yeah, and actually, the one decision that I know has been made is the BBC won't be sending me out there, which is a real shame, because that'd be the first Olympics I've covered without actually being at the venue. But I totally understand why, and I think the more decisions we make actually that limit Japan's exposure, I think that makes it more likely that it will go ahead, that people are quite respectful and say, well, if we don't need to be there and we can still do the job well, let's do it from here. And actually, with the time difference being the way it is, the highlight show that I'm doing in the evenings, our time, would have been at 4 a.m. Tokyo time. So I wouldn't have been able to do it. We weren't planning to do it live, whereas this way around we can do it live. And I think it'll be better for it. And I'll be based up in Salford and just get on with it. And they haven't yet made a decision about Channel 4 and the Paralympics, but I'm hoping I'll still be able to go to Tokyo for that.
And for someone who is always so busy, what's lockdown been like for you?
Interesting. I mean, I actually, because I had 2 writing projects last year, that kept me fairly busy. And Heroic Animals was a real joy to work on because it's lots of short chapters. You know, it's 100 different animals. So if I was doing 3 or 4 animals a day, I felt like I was doing a good day's schoolwork. And I wrote another book for children that's out a little later this spring. But in a way, I've surprised myself at being quite happy in slowing down. I mean, I don't mind not jetting around and not much as I would love to have been at a proper dinner tonight, and I'm sure we all would have been. I'm okay with having supper at home every night and watching The Chase at 5 o'clock as the end of my day. I'm quite happy with that. It's amazing how easily I've settled into it. And there was a very frustrating period when the golf courses were shut, and I was an awful lot happier being able to play golf. And actually, my handicap came rocketing down, so I was really pleased with that. But it's, you know, you make the best of it. And I think we are, it's very good for us to be, to learn to be stoic if we haven't been already. You know, I'm always like to see the best in most situations, so I've been okay.
It's traditional at the end of interviews like this that the one asks, well, what's next for Claire Balding? But you've done everything. You've been on it, as I say, every channel, radio, television. You've written books. I mean, is there something that you still feel you need to achieve?
I have been very vocal in my support of better coverage for women's sport, and I believe very strongly in that. And actually, you know, in terms of what I do, sport is the great triviality. It matters not at all, and yet so much to so many people. But I do think with the Paralympics and indeed the Invictus Games and with women's sport, it has a much broader impact. And I would always want to continue to amplify that, because I think it makes a real difference to not just to kids, to adults as well. I think it makes a difference to people's self-esteem. I'll certainly carry on writing, and you know, Simon, I'll broadcast for as long as people will let me. So I'm only just 50, so I hope it's not the beginning.
That's very good news. Claire, it's a great pleasure to talk to you, and thank you very much. Claire Balding.
Thank you, Simon.
My thanks to Simon McCoy and Claire Balding. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast and would like to learn more about the work of the Soldiers' Charity, make a donation, or take part in its many events, such as the Catherine Yomp, a 54-mile stroll through the Scottish countryside over 24 hours that simply has to be good for the health, or Wheels on the Western Front, an invigorating 100-kilometre cycle ride to Arnhem, or combine the mental and the physical by signing up today for the ever-popular Operation Bletchley, our virtual code-breaking challenge whose lines of communication go live on the 1st of July, please visit soldierscharity.org. From me, Harry Bucknell, farewell and thank you for listening. With editing by Michael Stiglianu, this podcast has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers' Charity.